Thank you for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.
In Italy, for 30 years under the Borgias, they had warfare, terror, murder, and bloodshed. But they produced Michelangelo, Leonardo da Vinci, and the Renaissance. In Switzerland, they had brotherly love, they had 500 years of democracy and peace, and what did that produce? The cuckoo clock. That was Orson Welles as Harry Lime in The Third Man. A famous description of civilization, and with its focus on the Renaissance as a time of terror, but also of stupefying artistic achievement, it channels kind of, you know, a slightly complex idea of the Golden Age, Dominic, which is going to be our subject.
I don't think they do make cuckoo clocks today. In Switzerland, by the way. I think they make them in the Black Forest in Germany.
That's correct. They do. Orson Welles got called up
by Harry Lime or Orson Welles.
He had to apologise.
Because, of course, Orson Welles wrote that. Graham Greene didn't write that. He wrote the film, but Orson Welles wrote that speech. Yeah. And, of course, The Third Man is itself the product of what people might see as a golden age of cinema, now defunct in the age of Marvel films and so on. So, yes, golden ages, it's a funny topic because it seems quite amorphous, but we all know what we mean. We all know, we all have a sense.
Well, do we? Do we? Because Faramir Zane has asked, what makes a golden age a golden age? And conversely, Diogo Morgado, the only man in the world more left-wing than you, Dominic.
Is that by his own description?
No, he's just a parent. I mean, he's very, very, he's asking, isn't the whole concept of golden ages incredibly outdated? Like the great man theory, the study of history has advanced beyond golden or dark ages to a much more interesting palette of infinite greys.
So he's an Orson Welles man, because there are greys in that Orson Welles.
No, I think Orson Welles is saying that the Renaissance was golden age. It's just that the context for the golden age is violence.
Yes, but, okay, fine.
But so, you might say that a golden age is a golden age that's a cultural effervescence, but is also economically prosperous.
Yeah, though the two usually go hand in hand, I would say. Dutch golden age, Spanish golden age.
The Renaissance is the classic counterpoint to that. I mean, so, Dominic, what do you think? What makes a golden age a gold? And is it legitimate to talk about golden ages?
Yes. So what makes a golden age? It's all retrospective, isn't it? It's a sense of loss, a sense of nostalgia. In a funny way, what makes a golden age is nothing necessarily to do with the age itself, but the age that follows it. So in other words, the age that puts it on the pedestal. So you need a sense of, so it's not that the whole concept of golden ages is not just about yesterday. It's also about today. So in other words, what makes,
so you can't have a golden age without an iron age.
You can't have a 1960s without a 1970s, maybe put it that way. And I think, as for the second question, so that would be what makes a golden age. It's perceived as a period of affluence or a period of success that's followed by one of disappointment. It's the kind of party and then the hangover. And the second point, you know, is it outdated? I mean, I'm sure historians, academic historians, would absolutely go along with this. I mean, I think if you sat in a university research seminar and talked about the golden age of this or that, you know, there'd be all sorts of disapproving looks and frowns and stuff. But obviously, I think it's hardwired into our kind of imagination, our historical imagination, isn't it? That we think about the golden age of Athens, the golden age of Elizabethan England, the golden age of, and also politically, political parties generally trade in golden ages. So the Tories have a sense of when Britain was great. Labour has a sense of when Britain was compassionate. And everything has been downhill since then. I think that's part of any modern political movement's appeal.
Isn't the anxiety around golden ages expressive of two things? One of which is the idea that, say, certain great works of literature or art or whatever can be said to be greater than those of other periods.
Yeah.
And also that the idea that it's somehow chauvinist to say that a certain place has a particular golden age, and what about the other places? How are you measuring the golden age?
Yeah, sort of. It's that classic distrust. Well, it's also that slight academic distrust of basically saying anything at all, which is.
Well, I think of saying that certain things were kind of better than other things. There's a real anxiety about that.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I completely agree with that. They're not better or worse. They're just different. That's the sort of the mantra, isn't it?
Yeah. It's Bob Dylan and Keats. When obviously Keats is better than Bob Dylan. I mean, everyone knows that. because Dominic, you said that golden ages are defined by ages that come after them.
Yeah, by and large. You're going to now annoy me with an exception. I know. I can just see it coming.
Okay, so this question from Max Parker: what would be the shortest gap between the golden age itself and it being referred to as such? So, I would say in the Western imagination, the founding idea of golden ages are Periclean Athens, and Augustan Rome. So those are basically for people in the West, those are the two pinnacles. And so when we had Mary Beard talking about classics, when you study classics, the focus tends to be on the great writers of Athens and of Augustan Rome.
Yeah.
And it was an important part of the mythology of both those periods that they were living through golden ages. So Pericles gives us a funeral speech in the second year of the Peloponnesian War. Spartans have been at the gates. And he says, basically, we're brilliant. Athens is great. We're the school, you know, we are the school for Greece.
Yeah.
We are the best. And I would say that, in reply to Max Parker's question, I mean, the golden age has already ended, in a sense, when Pericles says that, because very soon, a great plague is going to hit Athens. Pericles is going to die of it, and the Periclean age is going to come to an end. I mean, obviously, the genius of, you know, are we allowed to talk about genius? I suppose, kind of. But you've still got Socrates and Plato and the tragedians and Aristophanes to come. They're still floating around. But it is a horrible age of plague and war. So perhaps to that extent, the mythologization is going on. And with Augustus, you've got this famous fourth eclogue written by Virgil before Augustus becomes Augustus even. I mean, kind of when there's still a civil war going on. And he has this kind of famous description of a new cycle, bread of time beginning again, and justice and a golden age. He says the golden age returns, and he describes the birth of a child, a baby boy, the generation of iron will pass, the generation of gold will inherit all the world. And the Romans interpreted that as meaning this great golden age of Augustus.
Yeah.
Although, of course, in due course, Christians gave it a different spin.
But if we can unpick both of those. So first of all, Periclean Athens. Are people at the time aware, do they think of themselves as living through a golden age? And what was your answer?
I think so. Yes,
they do. They do. And do people immediately afterwards, so in Athens, after the death of Pericles, after the death of Socrates and so on, do they look back and say that was a golden age and it's been downhill since then?
So the golden age of Pericles is when Athens is at peace, it's strong, it's building the Parthenon, and so on.
And then the Peloponnesian War, presumably.
And then the Peloponnesian War begins. And I think, if you look at Thucydides, who's our chief, you know, who gives us the funeral speech, his book is, his history is essentially an account of how over-optimism, based on a sense that they were living through a golden age, is what dragged Athens into what becomes decades of war and ultimately defeat.
Hubris and nemesis. I mean, that often lies at the heart of all golden ages, doesn't it? The idea that doom and disaster are coming. You're in the middle of the party, but the hangover is looming. As for Augustan Rome, I mean, how much is that? So again, there's a different way that lots of people, Ronald Simon and so on, have described that period as the imposition of an autocracy after the sort of slightly creative anarchy of the Republic. That there's a dark side to Augustus. Augustus is a dictator. That all this is pure propaganda to justify his regime. I mean, that would be the obvious counter argument, wouldn't it? That this is a golden age of a Roman totalitarian.
Oh, he's not totalitarian, but yes, I mean, undoubtedly he's an autocratic figure. But against that, you know, where there had been war, he brings peace. And you know, Virgil is just one of a number of poets who celebrate the achievements that the world of peace that Augustus has brought about. And I think that, you know, to this day, it's looked back on as an age of great cultural achievement. And of course, it also has the overlay that comes from the fact that Jesus is born in Augustus's yeah. life. And so that Virgilian prophecy has a kind of Christian element as well.
But that doesn't matter for quite a while afterward. I mean,
no, it doesn't. But it means that even once, you know, the memory of perhaps the kind of the political context for Augustus is, you know, he's brought in this era of peace starts to fade, and maybe even once the kind of the hold of the literature of the period, which is massive on yeah. subsequent generations of Romans, once that starts to fade, because it. Christians come to see it as having this cosmic significance. The age of Augustus is the time when Christ is born, when God enters earth. Therefore, it kind of massively dignifies it.
But isn't that just one of three Roman golden ages, Tom? So first of all, just before Augustus comes onto the stage, there are people like Cato who have a sense that they're living in an age of luxury and dissolution.
Yeah,
and before then, there was a purer, more decent Republican golden age that's now been lost.
Well, there's a golden age where Saturn had ruled as king of Italy on the Capitol. Right.
It's quite a lost golden age.
the idea of kind of early Rome as virtuous and a noble. An age before they got corrupted by Greek sex manuals and celebrity chefs and the like. It's not exactly a golden age, though, is it? Because it's an age when there isn't any gold. That's the whole point. They're virtuous right. because they don't have gold.
They have nothing. Yeah.
They have turnips and they have war and they have their devotion to duty.
Right.
And what yeah. more does anyone need?
Great Dad's Army. What about what I would say is the third great Roman golden age? And this is the one that lots of listeners will be familiar with. Tom McTague sent in a question about it. The golden age of the Antonines. So this is Edward Gibbon talks about this in The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. And he says very famously, a quote you'll be familiar with, Tom, if a man were called upon to fix the period in the history of the world during which the condition of the human race was most happy and prosperous, he would without hesitation name that which elapsed from the death of Domitian to the accession of Commodus. So it's the age of the Antonines, Marcus Aurelius, Antoninus Pius, and so on. Was that a golden age?
Well, there's another question from Will Rester. Did the Romans believe at the peak of the empire that they were living in a golden age? And the answer is that one guy certainly did. And he was a man from what's now Turkey called Aelius Aristides, who in 154 came to Rome. He was a famous orator. And he basically, you know, he spoke to the imperial court and he said, Rome is brilliant.
Right. They must have been delighted by that.
They were. They absolutely loved it. And he described Rome as a great garden, the empire as a garden, that all was kind of order and beautiful orchards and things like that. And that, you know, the weeds had all been pulled up and everything was fabulous. And it's that that Gibbon is drawing on, basically, in his opening to The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire.
Yeah.
And of course, what gives it the edge is that we know what's coming. And actually, I think I'm right that Aelius Aristides in due course dies of the plague that hits the Roman Empire in the reign yeah. of Marcus Aurelius, and which is a kind of, you know, it's the first of numerous pandemics that sweep over the empire in the late second and throughout the third century, and kind of merges with the convulsions of civil war that basically means that people inevitably in the third century are looking back to this time.
Yeah. Crisis of the third century and all that kind of debased coinage yeah. and inflation yeah. and stuff.
So but, an age of gold is followed by an age of iron.
But so does that suggest, therefore, that the idea of a golden age is kind of it's absolutely inherent in the classical world sense of time, that there's a kind of cyclical, you know, the pendulum swings, age of gold, age of lead, or whatever.
Well, I think that the enshrining of 5th century Athens and Augustan Rome as kind of twin peaks is a feature of how the Roman world understands the past. Yeah. And indeed the Hellenistic world. Because so one of the key things in enshrining Athens as a golden age is the sense that, say, Aeschylus, Sophocles, Euripides, the great tragedians, that these are the top three. These are the top tragedians.
Sense of a canon.
And so, in Alexandria, when they build the library, they ask the Athenians, could we have the copies of the plays? And the Athenians say, yeah, but you've got to pay a massive deposit because otherwise you'll never get it back to us. So they send the copies to Alexandria, and the Alexandrians say, fine, keep the deposit. The Library of Alexandria and the kind of, you know, the sense that not just Homer, but the tragedians of Greece, of Athens, of 5th century Athens, are the classics, really beds down the idea that that was a golden age. And the same happens for Roman education, that Virgil and Horace and Ovid and so on get enshrined. And that, of course, then feeds through into the Middle Ages. And I do think that that Athens and Augustan Rome are kind of underpin the idea of golden ages for people in Europe. So you think of the Raphael painting, School of Athens.
Yeah.
That's what a golden age is. And of course, then it informs the Renaissance.
Yeah. But a lot of these golden ages, they're about power, aren't they? They're very powerful states that have exerted influence over their neighbors, that have won wars, that are now at peace.
Well, so that's the question, is when we talk, you know, does a golden, and that's the question that Harry Lime's piece focuses, does a golden age, is it okay for it just to be an age of great cultural achievement, like Renaissance Italy, or does it have to be an age of military and economic power as well?
Well, I don't think Harry Lime is right, because... I mean, we've talked a little bit in this podcast before about how, for example, in the 17th century, people had an idea of the Norman yoke. And implicit in that is the idea that Anglo-Saxon England was a kind of golden age when, you know, people would meet and decide in assemblies, you know, the laws and the future of their society, when the heavy hand of the Normans with their castles and their knights and their feudalism had not yet crushed the spirits of the English working man. So that's one golden age. Right. I mean, that idea was very popular with the Victorians. And indeed, it's popular with it's actually there in kind of progressive thinking a little bit, that there was a kinder, gentler, more bucolic age, which has been lost with the kind of, you know, it's kind of the Hobbiton, isn't it? It's the Shire.
Yes.
Tolkien's golden age is very much related to that. I mean, that's got nothing to do with imperialism and winning wars, and because Anglo-Saxon England was not a country that went out and fought wars by and large.
It was an age in which there was a lot of slavery, and the Norman conquest got rid of it. So it's almost the opposite of the truth.
Right. Well, I mean, you could say the same about Periclean Athens there, couldn't you? And Augustan Rome.
Of course.
There's a lot of slavery and there's a very big gap between rich and poor. So it's not a golden age for everybody.
No, absolutely not. And golden ages generally depend on it not being golden ages for other people.
Right.
I mean, almost by definition. Because what is it? The Walter Benjamin thing, that there is no monument to civilization that is not also a monument to barbarism.
Right,
you
exactly.
Know, the Parthenon was paid for out of the tax, you know, the donations that the Athenians extorted from the Delian League, and Augustan Rome was founded on, obviously, kind of, you know, the mass exploitation of the provinces. And I guess you'd say the same of kind of more recent gold. I mean, because you see, I do slightly wonder about golden ages, that I think that the closer we, I think Athens and Rome are kind of, they have a mythic quality because they're removed from us and they're distant from us.
Yeah.
But in more recent times, I mean, can you seriously talk about a European state having a golden age? I would say maybe 16th century Spain, 17th century the Netherlands. But
I'm just going to say, every week, Tom Holland brings me up and says, when are we going to do the golden age of the Dutch Republic? I mean, you're famously obsessed with your namesake country and desperate to do that golden age. So you do think that, right? I mean, you mentioned the golden age of Spain. People do talk about it. I mean, clearly Spain was top nation in the 16th century. Gold flooding in from South America, from its conquests. Tremendous explosion of artistic creativity and so on. I mean, Charles V is, you know, the most powerful man in the world by a billion miles. And it's, again, it's that pattern, isn't it? Spain is not so powerful in the 17th century, starts to become a bit of a basket case in the 18th century, total basket case in the 19th and part of the 20th century, civil war, and then, you know, Franco and so on. So obviously the 16th century looms large. And it would seem to me, I mean, obviously if I was in a Spanish history seminar, I wouldn't say this out loud, but I'd be thinking it. It just seemed to me bonkers to pretend that the 16th century wasn't the top century for Spain.
Yes, but I think in the case of Spain, so a lot of the cultural peaks kind of follow on from it, and they look forward. They kind of, so you've got Cervantes, Don Quixote,
yeah,
who mistakes windmills for giants.
Well, he's kind of in that cusp, isn't he?
Because he's on the cusp.
He's looking back, and then you've got, to an age of chivalry.
So, and then you've got Velázquez.
Yeah.
You know, these paintings of the court that is kind of, you know, there's a lot of vulnerability there.
Yeah.
In Velázquez's paintings. And I think that the effect of that is retrospectively to cast 16th century Spain as being slightly, its decline is hardwired into its period.
Well, that's
greatness.
Definitely true. But that's true of all golden ages, though, isn't it? You said it at Periclean Athens. You know the plague is coming. You know the Peloponnesian War is coming.
I'm not sure. No, I'm not sure. I'm not sure that's right. I think you know, the Parthenon is amazing, or Virgil is amazing. These are great achievements. Yeah. I think with Spain, the greatness is actually in questioning the idea of greatness.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Is that, I mean, I'm slightly thinking on the cuff here.
Let's hope those Spanish specialists are listening to this podcast. No, what about Elizabethan England? I mean, there was a film, the second Elizabeth film of the Kate Blanchett films is called Elizabeth, the Golden Age. And people always, I mean, my Ladybird books when I was a child talked about the Golden Age of Elizabethan England, William Shakespeare, Sir Francis Drake.
Defeat of the Spanish Armada.
I was just about to say, sending the Spanish Armada packing. We don't mention all the naval battles we lost, and our own attempts. They're strangely not present in the histories. But yeah, I mean, that sense of Elizabethan England as a golden age is absolutely, has for generations been hardwired into the British national consciousness, hasn't it? Or the English national consciousness.
Yes, it's an age of maypoles and merry England.
Right, exactly.
And it's clearly not true.
Yeah. But I mean, I think...
That's the problem. Because it's an age of inflation and plague. And
yes. Elizabeth having very bad teeth.
Isolation.
And paranoia about Catholic plots and all those kinds of things.
Hostility with Europe.
Yes.
Plague.
Yeah.
So inflation.
So you could say all those...
Problems with supply lines. Yeah, right.
You could say all those things about...
People will look back and say, 2021, a golden year.
But couldn't you say that about all these periods? That they're fictionalized, confected, kind of romanticized to some extent?
Yeah, but I mean, I reckon that the reason that people think of Tudor England, I mean, Elizabethan England as a golden age is principally because of Shakespeare, because Shakespeare is seen as...
Top writer.
You know, our top writer.
Yeah.
Top global writer.
Yeah.
And that... But of course, I mean, you know, Shakespeare, you know, a lot of his greatest plays were written under James. And nobody can say that James is Jacobean England is a golden age because he's Stuart. So the civil wars are coming.
Yeah.
But I think it's entirely down to, it's not just Shakespeare, but it's also the contrast between Elizabeth I, Gloriana, Virgin Queen, all that kind of stuff with the Stuarts.
But you see, I think that's the key.
I think the 1590s were a terrible time.
See, I think that's the key to this whole issue of golden age, is that contrast. It's not the age itself. It's the often politically drawn comparison with the period that follows it. Maybe we should take a break, Tom, and then we should come back and talk about... I think there's a lot to be said about 20th century golden ages, the idea of falling away from a period of virtue and so on. And we should do some more questions. So we'll see you after the break.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost 3 decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goal Hanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, welcome back to The Rest is History. And Dominic, on the subject of golden ages.
Yes.
Of course, one of the key aspects of golden ages was that people with things to say had to be provided with platforms, didn't they?
They did. They did. There were many platforms available, but one in particular, I think, looms large in our minds, Tom, doesn't it?
It does. It does. It's an online magazine that very, very kindly has sponsored us. It's called Unheard, and I'm reading here their own self-description. It looks at today's events through a wider lens of history and philosophy and is full of independent thinking and writing, and it's full of really great writing. Is it
not, I think it is full of great writing. I think it's... Is it not fair to say that some of Britain's absolute top historians write for Unheard? Is that right?
Top podcasting historians.
Yes. Can you think of any in particular?
Well, Dominic, I can think of you, because last week, you wrote a piece about how we might be returning to 1970s-style high inflation?
Chilling. A chilling piece, I think, is the technical term.
Such yeah. was life in the summer of 1975, you wrote in Unheard. The age of Shawaddy Waddy, 10cc and the Bay City Rollers. Harold Wilson was PM, Tom Baker was in his time-travelling pomp, Britain had just voted to remain in the common market, and the space hopper was the fashion accessory du jour.
You see, even as you're reading that, people are leaving this podcast and flocking. They're flooding. Actually, they're flooding onto Unheard's website to read this top punditry. But I'm not wrong, am I, to say that top historians of the ancient and medieval worlds also write for Unheard, don't they?
That's right. Yes. I also
right.
have written for it.
This is great spontaneous chat, isn't it?
Right. So, yes, it is. It is. So, Dominic, both you and I write for Unheard, which is an excellent reason, I think, for our listeners to rush off to unheard.com/rest, unheard.com/rest, and you will get a 3-month subscription for free, and you can read anything on the site, including me and Dominic.
And I believe, Tom, it's normally £1 a week. So our listeners, we are absolutely spoiling people.
Yes, we really are. Unheard.com/rest. And if you don't enjoy it, you can just unsubscribe. So that is truly an offer worthy of a golden age, is it not?
I mean, and talking of not enjoying it, the script says you can read Tom Holland on How Hitler Killed the Devil or How Martin Luther Would Rule Twitter. Now, we've done a podcast on that. Did you write that before or after the podcast?
I wrote it after.
So you just ripped off the podcast?
No. The podcast informed my views. I refined them. Yeah. I cut out the bits that you contributed and then...
Exactly.
There you go. Yeah. An offering worthy of a golden age. So I think that's enough. That's enough advertising. Let's get back to golden ages. Hello, welcome back to The Rest is History. We are talking Golden Ages. And in the first half, we were kind of focusing very much on ancient Golden Ages, early modern Golden Ages. But Dominic, if we look at more contemporary history, would you say that, say, if we look back to the 50s, there's a kind of conservative take that that was a Golden Age?
Absolutely.
Or you look to the 60s, there's a kind of progressive take that that was a Golden Age. In other words, is it possible for one's sense of what a Golden Age is to be determined by one's politics?
It is determined by one's politics, I think, when you're thinking about post-war history. And actually, I wouldn't even start in the 50s. Ken Loach recently did a film, Spirit of 45. And
yes, of course.
There are people at Labour Party conferences wear T-shirts that say, "What would Clem do?" And reference to the Attlee government post-war. So,
but no one thinks that, austerity Britain was a golden age.
You clearly don't read the comments under the articles in the Guardian website, Tom. I mean, you'll happily promote their Saturday newspaper, but you're clearly not digging deep enough into the website. Because if you read the comments, lots of people say, "Oh, that was a time when people looked out for each other, when we had a government that was pure, when there was it was tough times, but a real collective spirit and people pulled together and they showed compassion."
But you can't have a golden age if the times are tough.
But this is, that's a different, that's your kind of golden age that is like early Rome. You know, you said turnips and war.
Yes, absolutely. So
there's a kind of austere golden age, which is we had nothing but people.
Civic virtue.
It's so funny actually.
Well, there's a question on that. Where is it? Yes, Steve from Portslade.
Right.
"To what extent is the judgment of a golden age a moral one?
Yeah.
I.e. golden ages are looked at as examples of virtue and lost values." See, I don't think that is necessarily a golden age. So I don't think that the Attlee government is seen as a golden age any more than the Romans saw, the kind of early years of the Republic as golden age. They saw them as virtuous ages.
Right.
But I don't think
it's maybe slightly different. Maybe slightly different. I agree with you.
Because the 60s is a great explosion, not just of kind of cultural achievement, but it's prosperity.
I think some people would say the 50s were a golden age. So they would say, you're right, there's a slightly sort of, I was about to say Peter Hitchens, but actually he always says he doesn't think the 50s were a golden age. But there's a definite conservative argument, 50s, you could leave your door unlocked, full employment, the crime.
No immigration.
Of course, the 50s was the heyday of immigration. So much of this is based on complete mythology. By the way, as is the countervailing mythology of the 1960s. And those two things operate, obviously, in conflict with one another. You know, it's a sort of Beatles versus Stones, 50s versus 60s. You choose your fighter kind of thing.
And absolutely true of America as well.
Absolutely true of America. So, I think probably even more so, actually, that the 1950s and 1960s become kind of political tools in the 1980s and 1990s.
Yeah.
Clinton absolutely stands in the 1990s as the incarnation of 60s values, and Republic, and his enemies see him as such because they think the 60s were terrible. Now, the 70s, you can actually go through each of these sort of little slightly artificial chunks of post-war history. I mean, the 70s to some people, when I often obviously write articles about the 70s, and whenever I do, there's the comments underneath are fascinating because some people will say the 70s were all inflation, strikes, terrorism is absolute misery. Anyone who claims it was great couldn't have been there. And then the next comment will say, "What are you talking about, you Muppet? The 70s were an absolute golden age. We went to university, we had grants, we had unemployment wasn't as high. That awful witch hadn't come in and destroyed all our industries, blah, 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 blah." So those things are very, very politicised.
Yeah, so on that theme, there's a question from Rory Martin. "Nostalgia plays a big part of national myths and identities. Given recent slogans like 'Take Back Control' and 'MAGA, Make America Make Great Again,' does that mean most politics has to be about a return to an Edenic past?"
Well, I think it is, isn't it? I mean, there's always a sense. The nature of being a political opposition means that you are almost always saying there was a better age before the current government were in power, and we've lost sight of what makes us great.
Well, is that not true? Tends to be truer of parties on the right than the left. I mean, I know that the left have nostalgia for Attlee or whatever, Roosevelt in America or whatever.
Yeah, the New Deal, Great Society.
But I mean, it's kind of important on the left to say that the best days are ahead of us. That, you know, we introduce better laws, we introduce better employment rights, and things will get better. Things can only get better. I mean, that's the...
Well, that's your mate Tony's...
So the golden age is projected into the future.
I think there's a bit of both, actually. I think that there was always a sense of a golden age in the past, and particularly on the left in Britain right now, there's been a kind of sacralisation of the Attlee government of the 1940s, and a sense that that was the only true Labour government, maybe less so the Wilson government of the 60s, you know, because obviously they don't want to talk about Blair, because people often regard Blair as a sort of traitor and so on. But there is always a huge amount of nostalgia in left-wing thinking, I think. I mean, that stuff that we were talking about in the first half about the Anglo-Saxons and the Norman yoke, I mean, that's been there in British socialist thought since it was there in the late 19th century, early 20th century, when the Labour Party was founded.
No one invokes that now. I mean, I think there's a kind of real difference.
Maybe they don't.
I mean, it mattered to Michael Foot. It mattered to Tony Benn. It mattered to that generation. Does it matter to Corbyn fans?
Does Keir Starmer talk about the Norman yoke?
Well, Keir Starmer wouldn't, but would Corbyn hasn't, as far as I know.
I'm not totally convinced about Jeremy Corbyn's close knowledge of British history, to be fair.
You studied it at his public school.
Yes. We don't need to. Well, he's got an unfinished degree in trade union studies, hasn't he, from Polytechnic?
Well, in that
North
case,
London.
He must have it.
I think politics is always an argument about the past as much as it is the present and the future. And I think embedded in that is a sense of a falling away from an age of virtue. I absolutely think it's there, left and right, equally.
But I think also, would you say that, say, in a country like Britain, a country like France, where there's a very long tradition of political division?
Yeah.
That actually, it's very difficult to agree on a kind of mutually accepted definition of a golden age.
Yes, I do. And that's why I think the World War II in Britain is an exception to that, because it's the one period where you have a national government that's put aside party differences and the national interest. It's obviously a war we win. There's a sense of collective...
It's a collective, but it's not a golden age, because bombs are falling and there's...
No, but you know what? I mentioned Dad's Army. So in Dad's Army, which began in, I think, 1968, for those people who are not British, so this is an enormously, ridiculously popular sitcom about the Home Guard, the group of kind of largely elderly men, too old to fight, who were formed in the beginning of the Second World War to defend the country in case of a German invasion. So this is a sitcom about them. But the framing device they use is a reunion dinner. I mean, people have forgotten this. The whole thing is meant to be a flashback inside a framing device of a reunion dinner when Captain Mannering and the other characters are talking about what has gone wrong with Britain. And they say, you know, we've lost sight of what drove us in World War II. And they're kind of looking back to a time when everybody pulled together. And there's an absolute sense that the World War was a golden age when people worked together. And that's been lost in the 1960s.
Yeah, but it's not a golden age per se, I don't think.
Well, you have a very specific description of golden age that involves a lot of poetry, I think.
I do. But also kind of success and prosperity.
Yeah.
So I think it's interesting, for instance, that we tend not to think of the Victorian period as a golden age.
But I think people do think of the Victorian period as a golden age.
No, because I think that there's always been this kind of Dickensian shadow hanging over it. There's always been the sense of the workhouses and slums and industrial degradation and all that kind of stuff. And I think that's further complicated, obviously, by disagreements over the British Empire and so on. And so I just think that say, in a country like Britain, it's politically impossible to settle on any one period as being a golden age. And I think the same is true of, say, of France, where there are lots of people who would say that, you know, the French Revolution was a golden age of égalité and fraternity and liberté and all that kind of stuff. But obviously there are lots of French people who wouldn't.
But then they all look back to the reign of Louis the 14th and think that was a golden age?
No, I don't think Republicans would.
No, maybe not, I suppose. So you don't think there can be a modern golden age? I mean, do you not think that?
I think in modern European nations where there's an embedded history of left and right.
Yeah.
Of a profoundly different attitude, say, to the past, I think it's difficult to settle on a consensus, which is why I think that the last period that you can legitimately say, you know, as a golden age is kind of the 17th century in the Netherlands.
I knew it.
Because it's not really political. It's not really, it's ceased to be political. It's about kind of, you know, Vermeer and canals and tolerance and liberation and all this kind of stuff. And who could object to that? I mean, everyone loves all that. Everyone loves a canal and tolerance.
Well, the counter argument to that is that we had a ton of questions about the 1990s as a golden age. And clearly a lot of people
come to that.
Do think of that. So Tom McTague, who's of the Atlantic Monthly, who's already asked, we've allowed him to ask one question about Edward Gibbon. He says, when did our golden age end? Did it end in 1999 with the arrival of Putin in September 2001, with the invasion of Iraq in 2003, or with the crash of 2007-2008? Now, implicit in that is the idea that up till then, it was a golden age.
Which presumably began in 1989.
Yeah, and we had to, I don't have it here, but I saw on Twitter, somebody asked a question saying, they felt the golden age was 1989, 1990, 1991, when the world seemed to be getting inestimably better. I think maybe this is a generational thing. And of course, golden ages can be quite generational things. But don't you think that for our generation, the 1990s feel like a golden age of creativity, economic affluence, optimism, all those kinds of things?
And drugs.
Well, not in Chipping Norton.
of course not. Yes. Although on top of that, I mean, it's something that you said earlier about people saying the 70s were great.
Yeah.
Was that often people identify golden ages with their childhood. I mean, we did a whole episode on the 90s.
Yeah.
I mean, we've already done this. But I mean, I think that the sense that the West had won, that the end of history was being reached, Russia was not going to be a problem. So I think Tom McTague is right to identify Putin as a kind of shadow over that, everything was going to be kind of multiculturally harmonious. So again, 9/11 was a problem with that, everyone would want to become a democracy. So yes, Iraq was a problem with that, and that we would just keep on getting richer and richer and everything was going to be fine. So yes, the crash was a problem with that.
So you've done a very good job of not choosing one of Tom McTague's options.
I'd say the crash.
Would you? I'd have said September the 11th, actually. I think September the 11th was a definite sense of anxiety after September the 11th, I think. And a change in tone with the war on terror from what had just kind of change in cultural tone.
I do think you need money to have a golden age.
Yeah, I think money is a huge part of it. And it's perfectly possible that, now, I suppose that the shadow that hangs over this podcast is the sense of a golden age gone for good because the future will be worse than, you know, tomorrow will be worse than today because of climate change, because of there are so many people chasing fewer and fewer resources, all those kinds of things. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think there's a kind of dystopian shadow hanging over, well, everybody, obviously, on the planet. Maybe particularly for people in the West, because there's another Luke Brennan asks, has the West as a whole had a golden age, or even is it still in one now? Is it arguable that since the Renaissance, the whole world has had Western primacy for good and ill, and this still remains even with China's rise? If so, will the West's long golden age end soon? So I think that is a really good point, that in a sense, the West, you know, if you're measuring it by economic and military primacy, the West collectively has enjoyed a golden age because it has had a kind of primacy, which is definitely fading. And so the perspective, say, in India or China may be different.
Yeah, I definitely think that's right. I think it's been an anomalous period of Western domination, hasn't it?
I mean, China's an interesting one because there the idea of golden ages is kind of fundamental to the whole way that people throughout Chinese history understand the kind of the rhythms of the cosmos, really, that things kind of come into the correct balance. And then you have a golden age, and then things kind of slip out of balance again. Emperors lose the mandate of heaven and so on. And everything gets upended.
Yes, surely that's right.
I mean, obviously, I think- that's that's, you know, in a communist state as like China is now, that's no longer kind of overtly felt or believed, but it must still be, I don't know enough about China to know, but I guess it must kind of be in the intellectual marrow.
But surely also if you're one of the winners of today's China, you must have a very potent sense of living through a golden age of growth, of optimism, of, you know, cities springing out of nowhere and so on. I mean, it's perfectly possible that if Chinese growth brings discontents of its own, you know, as growth so often does, that people, the next generation of Chinese, will look back on now and say that was the moment when we were culturally, politically, economically more powerful than we had been for centuries. Do you not think?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose that for the whole of Chinese history, people in China have, rather like the West has done, have been able to take for granted China's primacy, that it's central, that what's good for China is good for the world, and that the measure of whether there's a golden age or not is how well China is doing. And obviously the 18th into the 19th century, the discovery that China wasn't the Middle Kingdom anymore, that it wasn't the center of world affairs, it wasn't the fulcrum of world affairs. You know, I mean, no one could believe that they were living in a golden age with that. And now that China is kind of returning to its traditional position as, you know, the pivotal nation on the face of the planet, I don't know, maybe, well, maybe the sense of history as a kind of cycle of golden ages replaced by ages of iron will kick back in. I don't know enough about China to say.
I mean, a country that obviously
so we probably shouldn't be talking about it.
A country that's really never had a sense of a golden age in the past is the United States, until now, I would say. So, I mean, Henry Luce talked about the 20th century going to be the American century. And there was always this sense that, you know, absolutely picking up something you were saying earlier, that the about politics, that the future would always be brighter, that the American dream was of success and initially an ever expanding frontier and then basically ever expanding intellectual, cultural, economic frontiers. But since probably, I mean, you can see the seeds of that in the 70s in John Updike's Rabbit books that talk about the Great American Ride is ending. And now very much in the last 10 years or so, there's been a sense that you see it in almost all American public discourse, a sense that America's best days may, the fear that America's best days may lie in the past. And that's a big change, I think.
Which would presumably, if you believe that, then presumably there's a golden age by which you're measuring it against.
Well, the golden age, I think, you see it absolutely implicitly in so much commentary about American politics. There's a sense that the golden age was between, let us say, Pearl Harbor and Vietnam. Do you not think? The presidencies of Roosevelt, but Truman and Eisenhower and Kennedy, maybe in particular.
And with a difference, depending on what your politics is, whether you'd emphasize the 50s or the 60s.
Yeah, exactly. But do you not think there's an idea that the Cold War gave moral certainty, that America had a mission, that it was making progress domestically and eradicating prejudice and so on?
I mean, again, going back to that, the New Jerusalem of 45 or the early Roman Republic, a period of virtue. I mean, Americans did have that. The period of virtue was with the founding fathers.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, it's not a golden age, but it's an age that achieved great things, which I think is slightly different.
Yeah.
But I suppose that is now coming. You know,
that's now being revised.
These are all white men who own slaves. So
yeah,
that's.
So this is your Diogo Morgado argument that the golden ages. And of course, people say that exactly that about, as we've said, about Pericles' Athens, about Augustan Rome. These are societies about, I don't know, Ptolemaic Egypt or something. These are societies based on slavery and exploitation and inequality.
So have we argued ourselves into thinking actually there aren't golden ages?
I think we may do, which is very, very depressing. I think we should end with a couple of slightly offbeat questions, though. So Dave Walters says, is now the golden age of historians? And if not, when? What do you think?
well, obviously, I mean,
I think it is the golden age of historians, though, isn't it? I mean, there are more history books being written now about more periods. We know more about history than anybody before.
More is less.
Well, maybe. I mean, maybe
the golden, no, the golden age of historians was obviously 5th century BC.
As I know that.
Some Thucydides.
Well, that's only two, though, isn't it? I mean,
yeah, but it's only two.
Yeah.
Holland. Name two more iconic historians.
Holland and Sambrook. Yes, right.
Well, okay, so I rest my case.
Paul Duncan says, what is your favourite golden age? Well, we know yours, don't we? Isn't your favourite golden age the Dutch Republic?
It is. I just think that I'm going to stand up and say I think the Dutch golden age is a golden age. There was a big essay in the New York Times saying that it was,
yes,
I think,
it's been,
I think,
canceled.
Racist to say that it's been cancelled. I don't care. I'm going to risk cancellation by standing up for the Dutch golden age.
There's an exhibition, I think it's in Canada, of Rembrandt. I think it's Rembrandt, the golden age of Rembrandt's paintings. And I saw this online. Somebody's done a huge thing about it. Virtually every single caption when you go into every, because they're, you know, it's sort of very Justin Trudeau-like captions. So every single caption says, you know, Rembrandt painted this painting of, you know, some Dutch burger or something. But just think, if it hadn't been for slavery, how many more Rembrandts have been lost to us, you know, potential Rembrandts. So in other words, you can't just appreciate Rembrandt on his own. You have to be conscious of the costs of Rembrandt's world, of the casualties, all that stuff.
Well, that's fine. I think that has to be factored in. You cannot have a golden age without exploitation.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like, Steve from Portslade's question about it being a moral one. I don't actually think it is. I think it's about a mixture of power, prosperity, cultural achievement, and a kind of legacy that people can look back on without too much moral anxiety or political anxiety. Right. And I entirely accept the fact, you know, I mean, the Dutch in the Golden Age are proto-capitalist. I mean, they're not just proto. I mean, they are capitalists. They're setting up everything that that people now might worry about. But it's sufficiently distant. I don't think that we look at Rembrandt and think about slavery in the way, say, that we might look at a National Trust property, perhaps, and think about slavery.
Well, some of us, anyway. You haven't asked me for my golden age.
Dominic, what's your favourite golden age?
I don't know. I'm still thinking about it, to be
But why did you ask honest. Me to ask you?
Maybe Britain 1976 to 9?
Go on.
No, I
Dominic,
think
you must have one, or you wouldn't have asked me to ask you.
I'm quite Gibbonian. I think maybe because I read, maybe because
Trajan.
I read it, maybe because I read, yeah, because I read it when I was a sort of impressionable teenager, sort of, yeah, exactly, the Rome under Trajan or something.
And
I think
that's largely shaded because, by ambivalence, isn't it?
I think it's largely because I picture myself as one of the sort of enormously fat men lying on a couch eating grapes, rather than as, you know, a gladiator in the arena or something. But I absolutely think that sense of Rome being a kind of golden age is embedded in the imagination of anybody who grew up reading Ladybird books or later on watching Gladiator or any of those kinds of things. Don't you? I mean, I think to me, Rome is the,
yeah, but so
is the epitome, actually.
But that Gibbonian description is so shaded.
Yeah.
By ambivalence and irony. So he's talking about Nerva, Trajan, Hadrian, the Antonines, who delighted in the image of liberty.
That's not me. I delighted in the image of liberty, but not the substance.
Well, fair enough.
I pose as a libertarian. Well, I don't even pose as a libertarian. I pose as a freedom-loving person, but actually I'm an autocrat.
Are you?
Yeah, I'm quite autocratic, actually.
Well, on that bombshell, self-avowed autocrat Dominic Sambrook.
Well, yeah, it goes hand in hand with the whole Marxist historian thing, right?
I mean,
you know, it could be Ceausescu.
Yes.
Right. We're just
degenerating. Gibberish.
We haven't done that for a while because we've been doing some quite focused episodes on Watergate and Thermopylae and stuff. And before we start this, I thought we haven't done a really vague, rambling
drivel-filled one. Anyway, so on that note,
yeah.
Do you have anything else sensible to say?
Yeah, we've got a very good podcast coming up, actually, about medieval science.
Yes, we do.
Which
was
I think
it the golden age of science?
Yeah, which I think people will really enjoy because it will be much more focused and there'll be proper facts in it. And we've got a guest, so that's something. So we shall see you hopefully next time. Goodbye.
If we haven't put you off for good. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, please sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.